This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Let's start with the overarching question. What is Christian nationalism?
Well, I think over the last 2 years, I've answered that question like 100 times. but it's a very important question. So it depends on who you talk to, you'll get different answers. So before my book came out, it was kind of a sociological question. Mainly activist sociologists were trying to capture some group. And so they would come up usually with a list of beliefs. The most famous one is a list of 6 different beliefs that actually is a horrible survey design, and it doesn't capture much at all. But anyway, so that's the nature of activist sociology. It's usually garbage scholarship, and it is. So there's that. But my definition is, to put it simply, is that you have a nation that understands itself as Christian. In a way, we say we the people are a Christian people. And from that, we then, as a people, order ourselves through laws and custom for Christian good. So not only the kind of earthly things that we enjoy, good families, good vocations, good social life, recreation, all those things that we enjoy, but also the highest good as well. The highest good is eternal life in Christ. And so the nation, as a Christian people, will say, we're going to have all those earthly goods, but also we're going to orient ourselves to the highest good, which is eternal life in Christ. So that's my kind of simple definition. It's very broad, which means any nation can be Christian and also retain its unique customs and traditions and still love its place, love its people more than other people. So you can have South African Christian nationalism, Hungarian Christian nationalism, American Christian nationalism. And that would, each one of those would look different in their customs, in their language, in their law, their political system. But at the same time, they'd all be equally a Christian nation. So it opens a possibility for difference and good difference and variety. And so it's not as if I'm collapsing every nation in the same kind of cookie cutter system or a set of laws or set of customs. So you can be who you are and yet still be a Christian people.
You use the word nationalism, which of course is quite a loaded word. How does that differ from, say, patriotism?
I think the distinction is actually kind of silly. People are trying to, they have connotations of what nationalism is. And there certainly are bad connotations to that if you want to center it around Nazi Germany or European fascism or whatever. So they say patriotism instead of nationalism. I don't see actually much of a difference if you take the way I proceed with nationalism. So I don't actually, in my book, I don't start with, hey, here's the historical understanding of nationalism. I'm just trying to fit myself in there, in that somewhere. I don't do that at all. I just take the concept that nations are real, that they are real things, and that nations seek their own good, and they ought to seek their own good, and that's through law and custom, and that's the ism, that's the nationalism part, is that it's a people self-conscious of themselves as a people, and they say, we are going to order ourselves for the good. And that's how I understand a nationalism. I'm very upfront where I say, I don't care if this overlaps or doesn't, or if it contradicts nationalism. The point of the book is to contribute to the scholarship on nationalism or try to, so it's not like that at all. So to try to, frame my book, The Case for Christian Nationalism, situated in that literature and that historical sense of nationalism would probably lead you into misunderstanding. So anyway, I don't think there's actually much of a difference. If you love your country, you're going to seek your country's good. And a Christian in a Christian nation would seek its national good. And that's how I understand nationalism.
Your book, which I've got, The Case for Christian Nationalism, also suggests that it's a biblical idea.
Yeah, I mean, Romans 13 says that the magistrate is to suppress evil and to promote what is good. We certainly have this in the Old Testament as well, with the kings of Israel promoting true religion. And I don't think you don't even have to proceed from the Bible. You can just know that what is politics, but the people of that people of that nation seeking their good. And one of those goods is actually eternal life. Not eternal life in the sense that a nation as such can be saved, but that the individuals in there, the people, the families are Christian. And so that ought to be promoted. That's what nations do, is they seek their good. They seek the promotion of their good. Now, that doesn't mean that they should seek the good by exploiting others, other nations, or to hate other nations, or to seek the domination of other nations. But it does, in our domestic policy, which all nations have, we seek our good, and that would include even the highest good. So this would include things like, I think Sunday Sabbath laws are appropriate. At times, perhaps blasphemy laws are appropriate. It's good for people to have Christmas traditions and customs during those times. So, a lot of times city councils and counties would have Christmas parades, and they'd have these other traditions, holidays. All those are good, and so they ought to be pursued.
It's interesting. It's not as though the case needs to be made because it, in a way, puts you on the back foot, on the defense. I mean, if you look at the Middle East, these are, in many ways, Muslim national nations or Muslim nations, and they don't find a reason to defend it. They just are. It's assumed. So in the same way, you're saying that, let's say, in the case of the United States, it's assumed that the nation is Christian.
Yeah, and what's funny is that most Muslims in Muslim countries would look at the West and say they're Christian countries. Muslims don't really have a problem with talking about their country as being Muslim. And there's disputes between themselves as to what that's supposed to look like. But still, the question itself is not very controversial. There's a few liberals in Europe, from what I understand. But in Muslim nations themselves, even if they allow for religious diversity, they understand themselves as the core and deciding factor of their country. So yeah, it's not a dispute there. And it really, even among Christians for millennia, it wasn't actually a big dispute. Everyone, until fairly recently, wanted some form of a Christian nation. And only very recently, within the last couple centuries, and actually more intensely within the last few decades, did Christians start questioning the idea of a Christian commonwealth, a Christian state, a Christian nation itself. I would say even the American founders, even though they created a system that eventually led to disestablishment among the states, so there was no established church, they still saw Christianity as a fundamental, essential element to liberty, political liberty. More particularly, Protestantism. They saw the Anglo-Protestant tradition as being the source of the sort of liberties that they enjoyed. And so this is why most of the founders would talk openly about the need for a religious people. And by religion, they meant mainly Protestant Christianity as fundamental to the sort of political liberties that we enjoyed. So yeah, it was not a controversial thing for most of Christian history. And it's kind of ironic that a lot of people in my circles who are mainly Calvinist or Reformed, their theological heroes are unashamedly Christian commonwealthists or Christian city-statists or Christian nationalists, and would call upon their civil magistrates to act justly with regard to Christian people. So I'm not saying that people cannot disagree with that, but it is strange when you find this almost visceral emotional reaction to the concept of a Christian nation when all of their theological heroes thought that was just the default obvious answer. And so even if you disagree with them, you know, chill out, calm down a bit. I mean, it's your heroes disagreed, so you should probably calm down just a slight bit.
If you look up the term on the internet, it always seems to be surrounded by the word controversial or whatever, taboo. Why is the idea, do you think, controversial?
Yeah, I mean, there's several reasons. One would be that it is true that Christian nationalism, or the idea of a Christian nation that is self-confident and promotes the Christian good and a Christian culture, that is directly opposed to the elite of the West. It's directly opposed to the kind of coastal elite that run things in the United States, or did until Trump won. We'll see how those things change. But yeah, so it would basically strip them of power. Like, you wouldn't have these hardcore atheistic sort of secularists in power if we have a Christian nation. They would be marginalized. That's the first thing. But just in the general population, I think that over the last several decades, people have been socialized into secularism. And this is why I get a strong negative reaction from many Baptists and even Presbyterians in the U.S., because they think that secularism is normal. And it's become normal to the point of, well, it's normal and it's right. And the reason for that is they were raised in a unique time in American history after the courts, the Supreme Court in the 50s and 60s, applied the First Amendment to the states, called the, usually through the doctrine of what's called the Doctrine of Incorporation, and it eliminated religion from public institutional life in those two decades. And so most of the people alive in the U.S. today went through public school, or their relationship to institutions, mainly civil institutions, government institutions, is one of basically neutrality, or that's the stated principle, religious neutrality, or basically secularism. And so that seems normal to them. That seems, and now it seems right to them. Now, if you look at American history, that is not normal. That's very abnormal. But because it's been normalized, they think that's right. And so it's a difficult kind of uphill battle for people like me to try to break them free of their political socialization and to say, actually, for the most of the 19th century, in the founding period, and of course before, also in the first half of the 20th century, most Americans said we're a Christian country and we ought to act like it. There, even the left wing side of the what we call the progressive era in the early 20th century, even those guys said that their argument was, if we're a Christian nation, then we ought to have these social policies. And then the next premise is, we are a Christian nation, so therefore we should have the social policies. Now, I don't agree with all those social policies, but still I agree with the premise that we're a Christian nation. And it wasn't until after World War II that we suddenly said, oh, wait a second, let's take a line here from Thomas Jefferson. Let's take a line here from James Madison. And all of a sudden, we're a secularist, neutral country. We can't have an explicit Christian country or Christian institutions. And so all that was done away with, and now it's fundamentally normalized among even Christians. So you go your average evangelical, who I think you typically votes rightly, he'll still think that we were founded as to be a Christian country, a sort of religiously neutral state, which is just not the case.
I mean, what happened to In God We Trust?
Yeah, I mean, that's from the 19th century. I mean, actually, in the 19th century, there were several movements to even put Christ in the Constitution. So among mainly Reformed, you know, to call them Calvinists in the U.S., there was a movement to change the preamble of the Constitution to include acknowledgement of Christ in there. And their argument was not, hey, we need to be a Christian country, and by doing this, we'd become a Christian country. Their argument was, we are a Christian country, so why don't our founding documents reflect that fact? That was their argument. And the public would have agreed with that premise that we're a Christian country. And so that was their appeal to the public. It ultimately, there was some indication that Abraham Lincoln actually agreed with that preamble, but of course he was killed and it didn't pass. But anyway, even after World War II in the Eisenhower administration, there was a sense that we were slipping from our Christian heritage, and there was an effort to combat that. But then the Supreme Court in the 60s just kind of obliterated it. Also Lyndon Johnson presidency. So, but nowadays you talk to Christians, and their idea of God is like this, even if theologically in church, they'd say it's a triune God, Christ is second person Trinity, they would kind of, in the public life, God would be almost like the God of the philosophers, or maybe even more, they'd use phrases like Judeo-Christian God. In ways like that, the idea of Judeo-Christian is something entirely new. It's the last few decades. Before that, God was the God of the Old Testament and New Testament, namely the triune God. It's kind of an uphill battle. It's difficult, but we're making kind of inroads and trying to get people back to actually, we have to focus on the Christian God. That is the God of the world and ought to be reflected in public life.
What is the difference, if there is, between Christian nationalism and Christian Zionism?
Yeah, so Christian nationalism would be not necessarily anti-Zionism, but it would be opposed to the theology that usually accompanies that. So Christian Zionism would be opposed, because Christian Zionism is built on, typically on a form of dispensationalism, which is a fairly new theology. And I don't want to get into the particulars of it, but it basically sees the state of Israel as fulfillment of divine prophecy. And so in order to create the conditions for the end time, restoring the state of Israel is a function. So it's actually a part of Christian duty to support the state of Israel. It's a theological duty. So apart from geopolitical questions of balance of power in the Middle East, you know, should we fund Israel so that they can be a balance of power against Iran? I mean, that's not the question Christian Zionists are asking. That's a sort of question I would ask. But they're asking whether they have a theological duty to support the state of Israel. And I would deny that. as would most of Christian history. So I would say, yeah, it would be oppose Christian Zionism. Now, the Jews seeking their own homeland somewhere, you know, or any group of people who seek some homeland somewhere is in itself not opposed to Christian nationalism. That would actually make some sense in Christian nationalism. But it wouldn't give any sort of privileging or theological consideration to Jewish nationalism.
I mean, I can understand that because, I mean, I'm a white South African. And of course, as we all know, white South Africans are a fairly new idea. We're talking literally just a few centuries. But here we are, and now we have our own nationalism. And as you pointed out, Christian nationalism, in many ways. I mean, South Africa is also, I guess, a Christian nation, so to speak, although it's very divided. But I'm just adding to your point about, you know, finding a homeland.
Yeah. So yeah, like in itself, again, is it like a people seeking there to have a homeland is perfectly fine. People on my side, I think Christian nationalism itself would push back strongly against the idea that we have a special duty to the Jewish people with regard to the state of Israel. I would suggest that we Christians should treat Israel, the modern state of Israel, as simply a state among states, as a geopolitical entity. And if we consider Iran to be our enemy and Israel to be a friend, then they are in that regard, someone to be supported, but for no other reason. There is absolutely zero theological reason to support the modern state of Israel.
Christian nationalism, if I'm following you correctly, implies a duty of the state. In other words, the secular idea is that the church and state should be separated, but you're suggesting, I'm assuming, they should not be separated then.
Yeah, I think there are duties, broad general principles of the state. One thing I hesitate to say is to give some kind of program, like the state must do this and the state must do that. I was in Hungary two or three months, and I was talking to Christians in Hungary, and they are much more comfortable with a state acting on their society in various ways. They think that there ought to be a positive relationship between the people and the state. And the state will act and will create laws for their good in ways that Americans would not like. And I think that's fine. I'm not going to challenge them on that. I don't see any point in saying, actually, free market, this or that, and limited government. I see no reason to do that. In the American tradition, there's always been kind of an adversarial posture in relation to the state. And I, as an American, I feel that as well. I do think, however, that that doesn't mean religious neutrality. That just simply means that in terms of what we would have a probably stronger sense of the government's role as being far more limited. We also have strong notions of freedom of speech, which I think have been abused the last few decades. So there is a type of openness to the American, the American project that would be different. But anyway, I do think, yeah, there is a role for the state in suppressing things that are universally bad at the very least. I think atheism is bad and ought to be suppressed in various ways. It could be punished like through civil law, but I think just institutionally it should be separated. It should be considered something that if people hold to atheism, they would not ordinarily hold certain public offices and positions of power. Even like the father of classical liberalism, John Locke, said that. I mean, the father of modern religious liberty said that we cannot have atheism because they can't be trusted and other things. Also, if you just look at the polling data on what atheists believe, it's atrocious. It's like the opposite of anything good and beautiful. They are the most driven to affirm what is hideous and ugly in morality at the very least. And so for that reason, it's worthy of suppression and that the state could do that.
Do you think that morality can be enforced?
Well, certainly outward behavior can be enforced. There's always the question of prudence, whether or not it's going to actually work. So it depends on the people themselves. Some people are going to be far more conformist and compliant. Americans, at least with regard to law, are less compliant, it seems. But yeah, the outward behavior can be enforced, and it can also change the mind. So if you take, for example, the gay marriage that was forced upon every state in the U.S. in 2014, at that time, it was about 50-50, and it was 50-50 for quite a while. on whether or not there should be gay marriage. Some states banned it, some states permitted it, and then was forced upon all the states. Well, within a few short years after that happened, it became now like 75-80% affirm the goodness of homosexual marriage. And that's just one piece of evidence that when you legalize something, it tends to have this kind of tutelary effect. It has an effect of teaching the people what is right and wrong. And this is why good laws are important, because they will then teach people what is good. And if it's a bad law, it'll teach people to affirm what is bad. So anyway, yeah, morality can be legislated, but only with regard to outward behavior, but also over the long term, it can shape the way people understand morality internally.
What about Roe versus Wade, for example?
Yeah, so that's another example of something that the states should have had to contend with. I think there's a good argument for the federal government banning abortion in all 50 states. But at the very least, that's something the states should have dealt with from the very beginning, and they actually were. And then that was forced upon the entire country by the Supreme Court. That's one of those issues where there was a strong religious reaction to it. And before that, abortion was considered bad, but apart from the religious element, the people who were not very religious were basically just went towards affirming abortion afterwards. But there was just a strong reaction against it, and it became a central feature of religious conservative politics. You mentioned that was really the kind of the single issue that created the block of the evangelical voting block in the 80s and 90s. And it's what swung even conservative Christians to the Republican Party. So before Roe v. Wade in the 60s and 50s, Protestants would vote for either party. So it depends on what it was. If you're in the South, sometimes you vote for the Democrats until there was a realignment in the North. So it would all be different. The issues were different. And then once Roe v. Wade happened, the evangelicals turned into a strong voting bloc for the Republican Party that endures to this day. And they've actually, they are on the Republican side, the demographic that is the most reliable voter for Republicans.
Do you think Kamala Harris's position on abortion swung a lot of women in the other direction?
I don't know. It was kind of surprising because it was about 50-50 for white women. I think white women voted for Trump more than Kamala. So is it Kamala or Kamala? I don't even know. I still didn't even learn, but I don't care.
Ignore me. I'm not American.
I don't even know, actually. I think it's Kamala. Anyway, I think that did influence women. And the Democratic Party, they made it their central part of their various campaigns, which didn't work. The Democrats used it in ways that I think were really evil. I mean, not only for evil end, namely abortion, but evil in that they exploited the anxieties of women. All women, even if they're very, you know, they're not sleeping around, there is that kind of fear of getting pregnant and being unwanted. So if there's rape or whatever, so you can really play up on women's fears. And then we all already have a mental health crisis in the country that has mainly been targeted at women. White women in particular have very high rates of mental illness. And this just played into that. So the Democrats were exploiting the anxieties of women, particularly women who already have mental illness. And so it was really, really evil. And I was glad to see that in the end, white women actually voted more for Trump. Going forward, this is going to be a central issue. Several states have had referenda on this. So it's essentially a Democratic direct vote for abortion. And you have surprising conservative states that went to legalize abortion. So Ohio, I believe Missouri just passed one. It barely failed in Florida.
But I mean, look, I mean, let's not beat around the bush. In my view, I think it's a pretty terrible thing to do. My wife was saying to me this morning when our son was 20 odd weeks, when she was pregnant, 27, 8 weeks, whatever, he was already fairly fully formed. Imagine now killing that. And she said, you know, that would have just been murder. I mean, he's a separate little human being. And the question that arises is, how have we reached this point? Do you think that if there were more, shall we say, Christian nationalists, we wouldn't be asking this question?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most reliable opposers of abortion are Christians, particularly conservative Protestants. So absolutely, this would not be an issue. I mean, one of the issues, though, is that a lot of women have had abortions. A lot of women think of their daughters, that they think of the way they acted in college, and they know their daughter is going to go to college, and now they don't want to have their daughter be a single mother after it, during college or anything, that sort of thing. They play up on these anxieties. And really they're, because of the push for careerism among women, the emphasis on economic participation among women, having children is a hindrance to successfully competing against men. Typically, men don't take on the principal role of raising children. Of course, they raise their children, but they're usually the breadwinners. And so abortion allows women then to compete against men in the labor market. You put all those things together, and it makes sense why women would then want abortion. It doesn't actually make sense morally, of course, but it does place it in a sociological context that explains things. There's all these sorts of dynamics going on. And I don't focus on abortion myself as in the advocacy because I do other things, but many people are thinking through these things and how do you appeal, how do you reach women given these dynamics to try to convince them actually like these are evil laws and actually it is murder. So I know that's in the works and people are, of course, for many years have been thinking it through, but the anti-abortion kind of pro-life movement is now had to readjust because so much of the focus was on Roe v. Wade, which was a federal law. Well, it wasn't a law. It was a federal decision. And so it had to be removed from the federal government. And now you're dealing with state laws and referenda. So
if I were to look at a Christian nation, what would the attributes be?
I think the central attribute would be church attendance. That's where you worship God. I mean, you can worship God at home in your private time. You can worship God as a family. You can worship God among friends. But church is where you have ministers of God with a sacred vocation, preaching the word, administering the sacraments. That has to be the central feature of a Christian nation. When you look at then places like Hungary and the UK and Poland, where they have either established church or a Christian emphasis, it's kind of sad. I mean, I think Hungary is less than 10% actually attend church. I think that's the central feature. A Christian nation is not simply one that has Christ in its constitution or in its founding documents. That would make it a very hypocritical nation to have that and yet not do any Christian things. Just like a true Christian, of course, you have faith in Christ in your heart, but that is then expressed outwardly in action through various things. And same thing with the nation. If you declare yourself to be a Christian nation, well, then you ought to act appropriately, and that would be church attendance. There'd also be laws and customs, of course. There's all sorts of things you can see. I would just say the central one would be worshiping God.
What does it mean on an international level? I mean, is Christian nationalism inward looking, or is it, you know, go out and make fishers of men?
I mean, my focus was inward. It was domestic as opposed to international. My book doesn't really talk much about international affairs. That's simply because I think that we need to, especially Americans, need to look to ourselves. I mean, we have spent so many lives and a lot of money trying to police the world. And so I wanted to focus on ourselves. On the international scene, it doesn't get around the basic fact that that the international world is full of nation states, and it's kind of a anarchy in a way. So it doesn't get around basic international principles of international relations. But yeah, a nation that is prosperous will be able to send missionaries to different places. They will also aid their friends, and friends meaning their fellow Christian nations, if they are, let's say, they're being, I don't know, attacked by a Muslim country. Of course, these things happened in our history, not as often nowadays, but these happen, and so we should come to their aid and see themselves as brothers in the faith and come to their defense. So there would be that added principle of nations as a sort of person in the international world, recognizing their fellow kind of brother nations and then acting for their good. But again, like I said, if you have a good, a wealthy nation with surplus can then fund missionaries. And America has done that since its very beginning. The American Bible Society used money to send missionaries all around the world. So yeah.
Is Donald Trump going to make America Christian again?
So the way I view Donald Trump is he killed neoconservatism. I mean, he also killed forms of liberalism as well. He shows up, and when he won in 2016, rather unexpectedly, he opened up. I mean, that's when he talked about the new right, the new Christian right, all these new right movements. It was because Donald Trump opened up possibilities. And then new institutions arose, different books arose. And then you have mixed with that social media where people can connect and get these ideas unfiltered from the mainstream media. All those things together made it so that movements like mine can actually happen and they can get traction. There was a sense from the Bush years and then the failures of Mitt Romney and John McCain and throughout the Obama years that conservatism is dead. Like it failed in Iraq. It lied to us in Iraq. It killed our people, wasted our money for nothing. And then other things as well. They didn't curtail immigration. And so now there's an openness among people of all ages, but especially people who are millennial down to kind of Gen Z, to say that all that was worthless and failed. We need something new. And Trump showed up and said, you can propose something new and you can win. And that just opened it up. And that's what we see today. So he's responsible for that. And now I think in 2024, the difference is that Trump is, he understands government. He understands what he did wrong in his first administration, which was often putting people in charge who hated him and worked against his interest. And now he understands it all. Now there's a army of people on lists to for him to just put into these positions of power. I don't know what's going to happen in the next 10, 20 years, but he has opened it up for change. And among Christians, they are changing their ways of thinking as we speak. Christian conservatives are always afraid of government power, civil power, within the last few decades. I think Trump using power to clear the filth out in very explicit ways is going to show Christians that actually power is good. Power in the hands of good people is actually good. And that will shape their imagination for politics. And hopefully in 10, 20 years, we'll get a more kind of robust, explicitly Christian political movement that can take power.
So you're suggesting he's paving the way?
Yeah, that's exactly it. To put it in a couple words, that's right. He's paving the way. And people ask me, is Trump the Christian prince? You know, that line, is he the Christian prince you wrote about? It's like, no, he's not the Christian prince. He is a type of prince in a way, as I describe in the book, but he's not a Christian prince. But yeah, he paves the way for that Christian prince to restore the American heritage of faith.
And to his credit, he's won the election 3 times.
Yeah. He's beat 2 women too. They're 0-2 against Trump. Wow. But the ministers can look at that and say, you don't have to listen to all the church ladies that tell you what to do, ministers. So Trump has shown you the way. You can just ignore him.
Stephen, when you say Christian nationalism, I'm trying to figure out what is the difference then just in being a Christian and being a Christian nationalist. Does the term nationalist or nationalism imply some sort of political identity?
The Christian nationalist, yeah, it is a political project. It is a political idea. I don't expect everyone who's a Christian to assume the duties of pursuing, arguing for politics. It'd probably be better if fewer people actually did that. Yeah, I mean, Christian nationalist is Christian, but I don't think every Christian has to be a type of political activist. But if someone lives in a Christian nation, then yeah, they're going to most likely adopt the sort of customs and way of life of that nation. And so you could say that's a sort of identity. I don't really like the word identity, using that very much, but they would assume as second nature the way of life of a people which is Christian. So in that way, they'd be participating in a sort of Christian nationalism.
Why don't you like the word identity?
I don't like the word identity because in our time, identity becomes this thing that you, in a way, you posture. It's something you almost like self-choose. There's like a range of identities you can choose from, and then you just kind of choose this one and make it your thing. And it's a way to distinguish you from everyone else. And so it's far too conscious in that sense. When I talk about a Christian nation, I'm talking about people who see their way of life as almost second nature. Like it's something that's very natural that you're born into, that you're socialized into. And you can think of that as an identity, but that's way too conscious. It's usually way too adversarial. And it's a way to kind of, especially like our world is a world of a kind of expressionism. I think there's one reason why people become transgender and others, because there's several reasons, but one of them is now you can have an identity. Like you were a loser before, no prospects for getting to do anything great in this world. And so now all of a sudden you can grab hold of this identity and all of a sudden you become important and you can distinguish. You have enemies, you have friends, and all those dynamics. That's just why I don't like identity. I would rather in a like Christian nationalist see themselves as adopting a way of life that is a traditional American way of life. It's hard to get away from the identity stuff, but I don't like emphasizing that for those reasons.
Why is a nation important?
A nation's important for one is that you're among familiar and similar people. And when you're among familiar and similar people, there's no sort of roadblocks. There are fewer, you have common social expectations, common manners. You can interpret, you know, turns of phrase. You can interpret their body language. You can understand the particular nuances of language. Also, you might have common goals, common ends, common cultural reference points. And all this means is that you can interact with someone with ease, and you can also conduct projects together. And also you have a sort of shared love of very particular things and places, and it would inspire you to sacrifice tremendously for that place. Would even signing up to go in the military to fight and die, to sacrifice your entire life for these people. And I mean, we need nations on the economic level because we have to, our neighbors, we have to exchange goods and services, which requires usually some norms of behavior and rules and understanding of their needs and wants, so you can provide a good service that's marketable. All those things, you can go on and on and on. But yeah, I mean, the ability to philosophize, make friends, to share experiences with people. You're at a mountain range and look at that. So all sorts of things.
I ask the question, it sounds rather banal, but it actually isn't. For example, I live in South Africa and many will claim the Rainbow Nation, you know, this is a success post-apartheid. We've got all these different cultures and tribes living within the border. But I would argue that we have multiple nations. We aren't one nation because of so vastly different worldviews and customs and traditions and even just appearances. So the idea of a nation, I'm suggesting, I don't know if you agree, but it kind of goes beyond just the political borders.
Yeah, and that's how I present it in the book. And I say explicitly that I'm not talking about a nation statism. I think of a nation as such, it's ideally that it's under a civil government. So it's kind of a political entity. But yeah, a nation as such is a people of a common history, common language, shared particular loves. And what this means then is you could have a multinational state, which of course, those of course exist. I was talking to Hungarians again, and when they talk about minority rights, these people are talking about minority rights. I'm like, minority rights? I wonder if they're talking about, like, you know, Jews in Hungary, or are they talking about, I don't know, what are they talking about? Like Africans in Hungary? What they meant were the minority Hungarians in neighbor countries that were essentially brought into those states through bad treaties after World War I. You have Hungarians in Ukraine, in Slovakia, Romania. They see themselves as a nation, broadly speaking, and they have interest in aiding these Hungarian minorities in countries outside of Hungary. And they have a sort of love for them because they're Hungarian, same language, same history. And it's just because of the working of history, I guess, the course of human events that led them to no longer be in the state of Hungary. So absolutely, that's the idea. And I think most people in the world understand this. Like in South Africa, I assume that the various tribes and the peoples there see themselves as that. And no one would, you know, presume you to think otherwise. It's really only in the West that somehow we have to have this universal man conception that each of us is just an individual among fellow humans, but no one else in the whole world thinks that way. It's just one of the weird Western concepts. In the West, we have a conception of essentially interchangeable humans. And so it's like when Bill Kristol, the neocon, says that all, you know, the white working class in the Midwest, they're all worthless. They need to be replaced by hardworking immigrants. He has no commitment to the people of this nation who have been here for many, many generations. he has a commitment to economic output of interchangeable humans. So it would be good to replace those people whose family has lived here for hundreds of years with people who have never lived here before because of what he perceives as economic output. That's the idea of the West, is you can essentially replace inefficiency with efficiency through people groups, which I don't think actually would work, but that's what they think. There's no room for an intergenerational love of place, a particular love for a people. There's only a love for production and consumption.
You make the case for Christian nationalism. Are there any examples currently? Russia maybe, is Putin a Christian nationalist?
I don't know enough about that. I think he's a Russian nationalist and Christianity is a central feature of that. I wouldn't want to say he's a Christian nationalist because I think he's probably appropriating Christianity for his own purposes. I'm not like a insane anti-Putin guy, but I think that's probably factually the case. This is the difficulty. You have countries that are emphasizing their Christian heritage, like Hungary's done that, Poland has done that, and African countries have done this, Uganda, Zambia, they have done these things. That is a basic feature of Christian nationalism in the broad scheme of things. There's no point in being Christian nationalist if in the end, it's not leading to the glory of God. It is true that you need national solidarity for the good of the people. It is true that religion can do that. It is true that a Christian people, I say the word, they can identify as Christian and that brings national solidarity. But if that's all that it is, then it's actually worthless. Ultimately, it should be about giving glory to God, which means worshiping God. So for that reason, it's given the church attendance in these places, it has not yet translated to, I think, good action with regard to religious goals. U.S. has very high church attendance. And it's just a matter of convincing those people that actually, no, we want a Christian country and not just high church attendance. Like, we want to have laws and customs that reflect that and to basically exclude the things that are antithetical to it.
How do you get there, though?
If you have a country that is largely Christian, even if it's nominally Christian, so they may not attend church, but they still, like in Hungary, they'll still baptize their kids and never go back to church. It's like the only time they go to church is when their kids are baptized in the church. They're infants. If you have that, the people who identify as Christians, then you can say, you can then convince them to pass certain good Christian laws. So that's one thing. Even nominal Christians can go along with a Sunday Sabbath law. Even nominal Christians can go along with, hey, we're going to suppress atheism. They can go along with having prayer in public schools. That's one thing. So in terms of the law, you should enact what you can enact for the good. So some things will not actually work, but some things will. And if you have a significant Christian population, with many of them being nominal, non-church attending sort of people, you can still achieve a lot of good through that. That's one element. The other element, of course, is just the basic preaching the gospel. You need people to be preaching the gospel. That's obvious. So I won't go too much more into that. But there has to be preaching of the gospel. It has to be applying the word to everyone's life. And there has to be, I think, also good theology. Well, one thing that's associated with that is, and this might be my Presbyterianism, but if you could encounter someone and someone says, you know, you get talking about Christian things and they say they're Christians. Like, okay, so what church you tend to? Oh, well, we don't go to a church. Well, instead of seeing them as like a little demon or as a little atheist or as whatever, you can say, hey, look, you have claimed the name of Christ. Let me suggest that you go to his house, that you go to church. Be faithful to your confession. And so this is a way, instead of seeing them as needing this conversion at the moment, you just call them, hey, you have a heritage of faith, if not individually, but also in your family and also in your nation. And what that means, that should also include you worshiping God. So you should go to church. So that's another thing as well, I think individuals can do, kind of get away from this like very strict conversionism. I don't know if this is true in South Africa, but in the US, there's this type of like immediate conversionism, where I think instead we should say, look, you've claimed the name of Christ, now go act as such.
The thing is, though, how urgent do you think your message is? I'm suggesting that it's fairly urgent. If I, as a outsider, am observing what appears to be an implosion of morality and everything that's good and decent about perhaps not just the US, but the West as a whole. Think about LGBTQ and men wanting to become women and et cetera, et cetera. It seems like it's a snowball rolling down a hill.
Yeah. I mean, I think recent events have slowed that. I am afraid that the Trump administration and the people around him will continue to normalize the LGB side of the LGBTQ that might actually be happening. So I'm concerned with that. Yeah, I've had people also say that, you know, you're like 100 years too late, Wolf. It's like you've been, this should have happened. And of course, people were making these case 100 years ago as well. So it's not new. It is very urgent at this point. And I think also at a time when there are weird dynamics in religion going on right now, where you have now younger men are more likely to attend church than women, than young women. There's just a report, I think Wall Street Journal or New York Times Post talked about this, which is really fascinating because for most of our lives, it's been usually women are drawn to Christianity. And most of Christian history, it's been mainly women over men. There's usually been a majority of women. In that sense, because I wrote the book for men, in my mind, I wrote it for men. I was addressing an audience of men. I never thought I'm addressing an audience of women. And that's actually very opposite of the evangelical world where everything is marketed to women, even books for men. It's like, hey, women, here's this book to straight up, you know, to straighten out your man. And so she buys the book for a man. That's how they all work. I wrote it for men. And now we're seeing the rise of men in churches. And so this is, in that way, it's a crucial moment, not just for the morality side, but also to engage these young guys whose mind is being formed and how they want to pursue life, what sort of political activity they want to do, what vocations they want to do. And so in that sense, it's actually, I think, very timely.
Do you think that a way to bring people into the notion of Christian nationalism is to be fairly principled and hard-edged about it and not nuanced and subtle?
Yeah, this is a complicated question, but I think, yes. I think that people want straightforward arguments. They don't want these kind of emotive, feminine type of dancing around an issue. They want just a straight argument. And when I wrote it, I said, I'm going to write this as best I can to appeal to a rational mind and not to an emotional mind, but a rational mind. And yeah, and people want that directly. And nowadays, people like truth speakers because there's more and more censorship. There's more and more weakness in the church. You can see a pastor up there dancing around an issue or they go left wing. And you know they're spouting nonsense, and to have someone on the right who could just say directly the truth and you know cite the statistics and do all the noticing and all that, yeah, absolutely. That is definitely and social media has allowed you to do that. The other factor is there are people like myself who can get away with it, and there's a lot of people who cannot get away with it. And so it's you can develop an audience who wishes they could say what you're saying publicly. So I can be the face of this, of the belief in suppressing atheists or something like that. Like, oh, these people all think that that should be the case, but if they say it publicly, they could lose their job or whatever. And so it's easy to build a sort of following because they kind of wish they could do that and hope someday that they can do that. And so they advance people like me and what I'm saying so that hopefully someday at least their kids can say these things openly and not get fired.
For those listening, how can they get your book?
Yeah, I mean, it's on Amazon, The Case for Christian Nationalism. It's on Canon Press app you can listen to it. I think on through Canon Press. Also, you can download it to listen to it. So that's basically it.
Are you on social media?
Oh yeah, you can do that. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. You can just search Stephen Wolf, and it's a guy standing by a river doing this. You'll know it's me.
Do we say? So, do we still say Twitter?
I say Twitter. I don't like X. I say Twitter.
How can you name your company one letter of the alphabet?
Elon can just do whatever he wants. I mean, it's incredible what that guy can do. That's why. Yeah, a friend was telling me that. If Elon doesn't get to Mars by the time he dies, then we'll never get to Mars. It's like he's the only guy in history who could pull this off, and so we're all, you know, championing for him to pull that off.
I've got a love-hate relationship with him. He comes from my side of the pond. In fact, he went to school very, very near to where my wife went to school. So he's, you know, what's that joke? He's the most successful African-American.
African, yeah.
What do you make of him?
I heard someone the other day call him a right-wing progressive. And that's a really interesting phenomenon. He is right-wing in terms of like natural hierarchy, meritocracy, stuff like that. He's anti-censorship. So he's kind of a somewhat older conservative in that sense. And he also wants action and wants things to happen. So that's kind of right-wing. But he is a progressive largely when it comes to technology and like robot technology, AI, and space exploration. He thinks that the human destiny is among the stars, that sort of thing. And that's all very interesting. I'm still trying to sort through exactly how all that works. I tend to be more of a traditionalist type of smash the machine sort of guy. But he is a fascinating figure. He has said some positive things about the Christian heritage of the West, as in a way that ought to be preserved. So there are positive signs there as well.
On that note, Stephen Wolfe, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.